And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I am Martin Willis, your host. Well, I've always striven or strived, whatever the proper English is, to have unique guests on the show whenever I can. And today our guest is just that. John Glass has a PhD in sociology and currently teaches at Collin College as a professor of sociology. He is a committed advocate of the use of the scientific method to discover and understand the properties of the material and human world. Well, he's been interested in the UFO phenomenon since early childhood, and he's unsure what to think about it other than noting the huge volumes of reports about this phenomenon. I really have no idea what he and I will be talking about and how we're going to approach the subject, but I'm sure it will be an interesting show. So hang in there. He'll be coming up right after the music break. Before we speak to John, however, our astronomy segment is coming up. So Andy Fleming, what is going on this week?
Hiya, Martin. Good to talk to you. This week, we're going to go on our UFO time machine, and we're going to go back to the year 1178 AD, and something I've called Impact Moon.
Impact Moon, as in a crater?
As in a crater, yes, indeed.
No triangle in the crater, though, this time.
No, I thought this follows on rather nicely, of course, from last week's podcast and the moon triangle.
Yeah, all right, well, let's hear it. What's going on?
This is actually some science here, Martin, so I think people are going to really enjoy this one. Anyway, and perhaps they can help solve it, more importantly. Do you have a pair of binoculars, Martin?
Well, I have better than that. I have a pretty nice telescope.
So, oh, nice one. Yeah. Well, obviously, and listeners, when you look at the moon through binoculars or a nice telescope, you'll see that obviously it's covered with craters. And they've been made over billions of years. And, of course, unlike the Earth, the moon doesn't have any plate tectonics. So there's no weathering or volcanism. So it's in pristine condition. And, of course, that's sort of like gives a history of the impact. I mean, you'll know that there obviously have been big impacts, and you've reported on them on the Earth. The one, it was an impact, I suppose, but the one in Russia last year.
Well, there's controversy on that. It may have impacted that lake.
Yeah,
you know. So I guess you'd call it a semi-impact.
Yeah,
it was
exactly.
Like 11 tons or something like that when it came through the atmosphere.
It was pretty big. And, of course, you'll have heard and listeners will have heard about the impact that wiped the dinosaurs out, the Chicxulub crater. And, of course, all of these get covered up on the Earth because of all the weathering and everything. And, well, the funny thing is that we never really see any impacts on the moon, do we? I mean, I haven't seen any.
You mean a live impact?
A live impact.
No. But, just a thought here. I would assume that the moon actually does protect us from getting hit by some objects. Is that the
That's correct,
process?
Yeah. Yeah, that's correct.
The not gravity, like Jupiter, but, you know.
Yeah, not as big as Jupiter, but yes, it has that that effect. So I've been doing a little bit of research, and I found out that there are some medieval records. One in particular, going back to 1178. Now, obviously, for people who know England, people have heard of the town of Canterbury in Kent. There was an abbey there, probably in ruins now. now, but in 1178 there was a whole staffing of monks, and the chronicler of the time, which was somebody called Gervais, wrote a deposition that he took from five monks, and it was about a very strange spectacle that they think they saw on the lunar surface. I'll just read it out to you verbatim.
Sure.
And this is what Gervais said. This year, on the 18th of June, when the moon, a slim crescent, first became visible, a marvellous phenomenon was seen by several men who were watching it. Suddenly, the upper horn of the crescent was split in two. From the midpoint of the division, a flaming torch sprang up, spewing out a considerable distance fire, hot coals and sparks. You've got to listen to this in terms of the, you know, the fact this was in medieval Middle Age times, and, you know, these were the analogies that they drew. The body of the moon, which was below, writhed like a wounded snake. This happened a dozen times or more. When the moon returned to normal, the whole crescent took on a blackish appearance.
You know, when you go back, you hear of all these stories that are quite spectacular. It sounds like this one is really turning into one. Something was going on, though, obviously.
Something was happening, yeah, definitely. They saw something, and way back in 1976, an astronomer from New York called Jack Hartung investigated in a science journal called Meteoritics. He developed a hypothesis that what we've just talked about was, in fact, a meteor impacting. And obviously, Gervais's account at the time, if true, is pretty much unique, as there's no other account of such a large lunar impact. It should have created such an event, should have created a crater about 10 kilometres in diameter. It should also have long ejector rays. So, of course, to prove any sort of hypothesis, you've got to start looking around for the evidence. And they did find a crater in the form of a crater that they already knew and had named called Giordano Bruno.
One thought comes to mind is, how would they possibly date a crater on the moon? Because, you know, there's no atmospheric things to wear anything down, and everything was just like fresh and pristine there, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. The only way they can, well, there are two main ways, through radiometric dating, and I think to do that they've got to have a spacecraft on the ground, you know, something like Apollo or one of the unmanned ones. As far as I know, this crater Giordano Bruno's never ever been explored by a robotic mission or a manned mission. So the only other way, if it's not isometric dating, I think it's called, the only other way they can do it is to look at the subcraters within the main crater itself. If the crater happened very, very recently, as in a couple of hundred years ago, there won't be any other smaller craters within the crater.
Has any astronomer ever discovered a new crater inside, say, another crater or anywhere on the moon?
Yes, it happens. Well, as far as I know, I mean, it happens all the time. The usual dating suggested that, as I say, it was pretty recent. They've since done some more dating, more analysis visually, and they've found that it's between centuries and 10 million years old. That's about as how approximate they can be. It's like, what's a few billion stars in a cosmos of billions and billions? But there are objections to Mr. Hartung's hypothesis, the original astronomer. The Earth showered by secondary... the Earth should have been showered by secondary meteorites from this in a fantastic firework display. When a comet or an asteroid or a big meteorite hits something like the moon, it throws ejecta up into space, and some of that should have hit the Earth's atmosphere and we'd have had a wonderful meteor shower. We didn't, apparently. There's nothing in any of the European, Chinese or Arab records to show that. And in 2008, a high-resolution image estimated it formed about 1 million years ago. But the case isn't completely solved. They'll only solve it when they do an age dating of the impact melt rocks, and of course that will be the next generation of lunar explorers. There is another hypothesis that what the monks saw in 1178 was in fact a meteor exploding in the Earth's own atmosphere, Martin, but there's definitely no doubt they did see something.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Andy, and we'll be talking to you next week.
Look forward to it, Martin.
Okay, hold on for a moment. We'll be right back with John Glass. And make sure you live listeners sign up on our chat room right now. It's on the sidebar of podcastufo.com. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Well, it's a nice mellow tune. It should make for a nice mellow interview with John Glass. How are you doing, John?
Good, thank you, Martin.
Thanks for joining us. And you have a PhD, and can you just kind of go into your line of study, and then we'll get into how you and I connected and talk about your ideas on more or less a healthy skepticism to exploring the UFO phenomenon.
Sure, sounds good. Well, I have a doctorate in sociology from the University of North Texas. I earned that in 1995, and when I was an undergraduate, I also studied sociology. I went to school in a small liberal arts college out in California. And then I've worked in the area of substance abuse counseling, grant writing. I worked in the field of domestic violence for a while, and then for the past 20 years or so, I've taught sociology part-time, and then just recently I started teaching full-time, and I've been in my present position for a little over 8 years.
I see. So. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you and I connected. You were actually listening to another, you were listening to Open Minds Radio, and you heard myself interviewed, and when I was talking about the debate I had with Dr. Seth Shostak from SETI, and that's how you and I connected, and I believe it was the phrase that made you engage, something along the lines where Seth Shostak needed something, a UFO actually in the Smithsonian before he believed that they existed. And
yeah.
Let's talk about evidence and what your approach is to, well, first of all, before we get into any of that,
sure.
I would like to find out what makes you interested in the topic of UFOs with your science background.
Sure. Well, I think ever since I was a kid, ironically, I always kind of liked the mysterious things because I thought that kind of day-to-day life was too rational and sort of too scientific to begin with. So I always enjoyed hearing about, you know, monsters and UFOs and kind of all the unusual unknown things.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember as a kid, one of the reasons I was interested in eventually becoming, you know, studying science, and obviously in my context, it's behavioral science, but I used to love to watch those. And I grew up in Ohio, and we had monster movies on the afternoon, and it seems like there would always be some kind of mad scientist in a lab, and he was, you know, twiddling dials or something. Or I remember a great movie that came out in the 1960s called, I think it was called A Crack in the World. And I don't know, I was always fascinated by scientists and how they would kind of come up with these really cool ideas to try to change things or to try to, you know, use scientific knowledge to alter something.
Mm-hmm.
And then Yeah, just kind of throughout my adolescence, those things always interested me. I guess I just was never satisfied with the generic explanations for things. You know, well, that can't be true, or clearly that's not what's happening, or, you know, no, that you don't need to believe in that. And then in college, college kind of opened my eyes. I really wasn't sure what I was going to study, and I ran into sociology, and it really helped me to understand the world a lot better and understand myself too. And along the way, some colleagues or some friends of mine and I, we just became more and more interested in, I don't know what to call it, paranormal or, you know, the unexplained, those kinds of things. Not that we had any explanations, but we just thought that it was all pretty cool and pretty interesting. And then since I've gone through graduate school and really learned about the scientific methods, I've come to appreciate the fact that through the application of the scientific method, we really can, you know, find out with fairly high degree of confidence and precision what's going on and why things happen, and then obviously utilize that knowledge to make things better. And that's my orientation from a behavioral standpoint, is to try to understand human behavior and then, if possible, design social organizations or social systems or social groups that will, you know, function better or more efficiently or have better outcomes, those kinds of things. So,
you know, it kind of reminds me, my son and I talk quite a bit about the UFO phenomenon. He's more or less a skeptic, but and about, you know, the whole paranormal thing, but he kind of says something along the lines of what you're saying, more or less, that if this is all there is, you know, that we know, then it's kind of boring.
Yeah, so, right.
Yeah. I would hope that there was something. And, you know, one of the things you said, you know, people do see ghosts, people do see UFOs, and you know what? There's an answer for every single one. Somehow there's some type of answer. And, you know, I believe that's 100% true. There is an answer, and we, as far as the UFOs go, we really don't have that answer.
And, right.
But to make the proclamation that we know that they're extraterrestrials is just as bad as a skeptic saying that they don't exist at all, you know? And what what would you consider, what do you think a UFO is? All these people that are reporting what they're seeing, like 30,000 a year reported, and they think that's only 10%.
Sure, sure. Well, let me approach it this way. I want to go back to the comment you made about being skeptical. And my understanding is that anybody who utilizes a scientific method, which really is, I mean, people talk about science, but really science is a series of methods that are used, which basically people have agreed upon that if you follow this procedure, you do this protocol, you know, do X, Y, or Z, you can wind up with a particular result that can be replicated and other people can check it out. So it's sort of a democratic process where you're able to really verify the findings that you have and you know, feel fairly confident that what you've discovered or what you've uncovered is something that's reliable. And so the skeptical part is, I think every scientist is always skeptical. I mean, we're even skeptical of our own findings because we're familiar with the limitations of any research methodology. There's always going to be some kind of limitation. Mm-hmm. So having said that, I think it's important to never kind of lose that sense of skepticism. Now, I think it can be taken to an extreme where you make proclamations, you know, these things don't exist or clearly that's wrong or something like that. I don't go that far because I don't know. You know, I don't. I mean, I think it's sort of arrogant to for any human being to think that they've figured out the universe. You know, I mean, it's,
right,
it just
right.
Seems like a little. At the same time, I think one of the things that is important to understand is that knowledge, any knowledge, and in particular scientific knowledge or knowledge that's generated through the scientific method, is conditional. And it's conditional upon what's available to us, the different tools or mechanisms that we have to make contact with the world. So obviously, as technology has changed and allowed us to do, you know, look farther into space or look deeper into atomic particles or something like that, then we get new knowledge. And so it's conditional based upon our current level of ability to explore and investigate. And then it's also conditional because we know that there's not everything to be known. So depending upon new technological advances, we might get new knowledge. Depending upon new discoveries or kind of putting these things together we hadn't thought of before, we generate new knowledge. So it's never, in my opinion, it's never fact. You know, it's never, this is the way it is and this is the way it will always be. So having said that, what do I think UFOs are? You know, I don't know. If I step out of my kind of scientist shell or whatever, you know, my belief system is, yeah, I'd love to believe that they're extraterrestrial. I think that'd be really cool. I mean, you know, I'd love to believe in Bigfoot and everything else, too. I think that'd be really cool. But at the same time, I know that in order for me to really believe in them, in a sense, as I believe in a table that exists in front of me or something like that, I need to have proof. So one of the things that I tell my students is when we utilize the scientific method, we rely on empiricism, which is basically the collection of data with one or more of our five senses. So the more data you can collect with one or more of those five senses, the better data you have and the more reliable your findings are going to be. So when it comes to UFOs, what are the data sources that we have? Okay, we have eyewitness reports, we have videos, we have maybe some recordings, we have testimony. But really those are, in a sense, only relying on two senses, right? I mean, and that, you know, they claim that there's radiation or maybe something that was found, something like that.
There's radar data as well.
Radar data, too. All of that, though, I would say would fall under the, in terms of senses, would fall in the sense of sight. Because what a radar does is allows us, in a sense, to see things that we normally wouldn't be able to see. So is in my mind, is that sufficient to conclude that there's, you know, something clearly that's it's insufficient evidence to conclude there's something extraterrestrial? Is there evidence to conclude there's something there? Yeah, probably so. But without more evidence, with more information that we've gathered maybe from, again, an artifact or, you know, something else, I think it's we're stretching the bounds, at least within the realm of sciences, to make a claim of what exactly it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I actually agree with you, you know, as okay. Hard as that may sound.
No. Huh?
I think that, you know, a lot of people just make the total assumption. By the way, anyone listening live on the Dark Matter Radio Network, please jump right on over to podcastufo.com. and get in the chat room if you would like to pose some questions or interact. Well, getting back to, you know, the thoughts of what they are,
mm-hmm.
Let's bounce back a little bit to the thing you always hear that people mostly in the science field will say, it's impossible for them to get here because it would take so many lifetimes and, you know, using all of today's physics, the thoughts are it's impossible that they could have ever visited us or have come here.
Right.
Or the way everything becomes extinct on planets, like 99% of species on this planet, that happens elsewhere, and we've only been here for a very short time comparatively mm-hmm. to the Earth's mm-hmm. existence. And how could these two, you know, cross? How could we cross with another civilization that's going to be wiped out? You know,
right.
you know, on
right.
and on and on and on. So what are your thoughts about, do you think it's possible that we have been visited and are being visited?
Well, let me start with, you know, whether it's physically impossible. I mean, I'm not a physicist, so I don't feel qualified to answer that question. I think the only thing I could say about that is it kind of goes back to what I said earlier about, you know, I think it's sort of arrogant you know, to claim that we have complete knowledge of exactly how the universe operates. I that just seems, you know, it seems unsubstantiated to me because it's a pretty wild claim that we, considering that if we're even accurate as to how large the universe is, you know, how much access do we have to it, and how do we know there might be something else entirely going on in another physical setting somewhere? So I'm afraid the physicists would have to comment on that. Having said that, you know, I still would not necessarily take their statement at 100% with 100% confidence, because what I said is that I'm always going to be skeptical, even skeptical of of anybody who makes a claim like that, because I think a lot of that, and you know, I could be way wrong, but I think a lot of it's based on, you know, mathematical calculations, which clearly a lot of our science is based on that. But that doesn't mean, in my mind, that that's exactly how things work. And there's something that I've paid attention to is that, and maybe it's a function or a result of our, you know, our being human, but there's always error in whatever we do. I mean, mm-hmm. we don't have precise measurement. So, and in some cases, you know, if you take a medication for, you know, heart disease or something, they always list all the side effects. Well, the side effects are the errors, you know, and sometimes it's astounding the number of side effects there are. But, and I think that that's a similar case in regardless of whatever science it is that we're, whatever scientific method we're applying. So in my mind, that opportunity for error leaves open the possibility that, you know, there might be something else here that we're completely missing. and then the part about, you know, whether we've been visited or not, again, to me, that would be, you know, an unknown. I mean, I think the only thing that I could come close to considering as being visitation would be, you know, the theory of panspermia. Mm-hmm. Maybe life, you know, is kind of happened because something landed here. You know, the claim that we've been visited by previous civilizations and they've influenced our architecture and all that kind of stuff. You know, I can't put a lot of credence in that because, in my mind, you know, it's kind of like that statement that Sherlock Holmes makes. And I don't remember exactly what it is, but it's basically, you know, when you've solved everything else, you know, what's left is the, or I guess what, that's not what he says. But my point is that we have to rule out all of the known phenomena first, known reasons for why something exists before we could even begin to consider an alternative explanation or an explanation that would be metaphysical. And I don't think we've exhausted that when it comes to understanding like ancient architecture or ancient technologies or anything like that. So in my mind, again, from a scientific standpoint, we would have to exhaust all of those possibilities or all those explanations and say none of these work. And even then, I don't know that we could just jump to the claim that it's extraterrestrial. Because still we would say, okay, well, maybe we're missing something. It goes back to that inevitable amount of error or that inevitable amount of limitation that you're gonna miss. So that's why I was saying, I mean, I kind of agree with Seth, not that I have to have it in the Smithsonian, but come on, can't these guys leave some kind of hard evidence that, you know, we can evaluate? I mean, I think that most, you know, anybody who's interested in science would just really love for a spaceship to land somewhere and say, here we are. You know, that's the kind of evidence that we want.
Right.
I mean, that's, you know, we could investigate that. And so, yeah, in my mind, that's the kind of evidence I would need. You know, I think all the other claims, people can make claims. I mean, this is one of the things that astounds me about a lot of people on TV when they make claims about ancient aliens and all that kind of stuff is they're welcome to make those claims, but they're not really, I don't know that they have the same responsibility that a scientist does in backing up those claims with really solid empirical evidence that's been vetted by a number of other people.
Yep.
I think that's the difference, you know, and I guarantee you, you know, I hear people say, well, scientists have this conspiracy and they're trying to, you know, they don't, you know, it's the non-traditional science and they want to keep all this information, you know, out of the mainstream. No, I mean, it's like, come on. If we had information like that, they would jump on it because you're talking about a Nobel Prize. You're talking about, you know, every kind of prize imaginable if you could prove the existence of something that was extraterrestrial or out of the ordinary. I mean, that whole argument just never made any sense to me. So in my mind, I'm kind of like Seth. I don't need it in the Smithsonian, but I'd sure like to have more evidence than we have right now.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe the evidence that is not here is purpose, you know, maybe it's purposeful of them not to give any. You know, there's certainly whatever it is not afraid of being seen. But as far as actually leaving physical evidence, maybe that's their intention not to, if that's what they are. But I'm not saying that's what they are. It's just who, you know, who really knows. But
sure.
One of the things I think about, and as far as there's never any funding or anything to actually study this, but along the same lines, there's a lot of funding to try to figure out what dark matter is, or things along that line that we don't really know, but we just think they exist. Like, I can't remember a dark energy and dark matter, how much of the universe they, what the percentage is of what they think.
Right. I think it's a pretty large percentage.
Pretty high.
I don't remember off the top of my head either. Yeah.
Yeah. But what do you think about that, about all these claims about from scientists about dark matter, because sure, they see what's happening with the gravity that doesn't make sense and things like that?
Right. So I think the difference between that and UFOs is they're building off of already known evidence. So, I mean, they clearly have some kind of empirical, tangible evidence that they've been working with. And, you know, when it comes to quantum mechanics or all that kind of stuff, I clearly don't understand that, and I'm not really sure how it all operates. But the point is that with these scientists, what they're doing is they're basing – it's kind of like that whole idea of they're standing on the shoulders of giants. They're building on evidence that already exists. So they have something to start from, and they have observations that have been made in the past that, you know, they don't – maybe they don't understand, or they it's not clear. And so they continue to investigate. But they're investigating something. I mean, they have some evidence that they're beginning with, that they're starting with. And I think that, again, this is the problem that we have with supporting the claim of what exactly a UFO is because we just don't have the same kind of evidence. I mean, if you think about a physicist or something, they actually have particles that they can observe, that they can see, that they, you know, they may not be able to touch, but they have a way of making contact with it. And they have it within their control, so they're able to analyze it and again, demonstrate it to more than one person. And this is the replication part of science, that before something is settled, before we agree that, yeah, this is what's going on, we have to have some consensus among a number of people. And, yeah, is there a consensus among a number of people that UFOs exist? Yes, clearly there are. But have those same people evaluated the evidence to the same extent that a research scientist would evaluate the evidence? That's the difference. And it seems to me that part of what happens is just because a lot of people believe in something doesn't necessarily – that in and of itself is insufficient to substantiate that it exists. But when it comes to things like dark matter, yeah, like I said, I think they're building on something that's already there. So they're not there's no speculation, or there might be speculation involved into what's going on. But then they experimented with it. They subjected to a series of tests, again, following certain protocols. And then they discover if their ideas are accurate, or maybe they discovered, wow, this isn't what we were thinking at all. It's entirely different. But they still have some evidence to go on. I think that's the big difference.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and again, we just don't have that when it comes to, you know, some these things that we're calling UFOs.
What we have in this situation is a fleeting, it's fleeting. And if it wasn't fleeting, then that would make all the difference. And it's, you never know when and where one will show up, you know, with the sighting that I had. You know, I was relaxing, not expecting anything to happen. And that's the way, you know, it generally happens. But one of the things that I think about is, you know, the mass sightings when, you know, thousands of people saw the Phoenix lights and saw
right.
the sky black out, you know, in between the lights over their head. And, you know, it was something. And,
right.
you know, the mass sightings, you know, really, you know, it makes you wonder what type of sighting that you would really need for someone to actually try to investigate something
sure.
like this, or take it seriously. What do you?
Well, I agree with you about the fleeting part. I mean, clearly, you know, one of the disadvantages is you can't call up a UFO at will and have it be available for investigation. That's obviously one of the big problems. The thing that intrigued me about the Phoenix lights wasn't so much the lights, but was the report about the sky disappearing, or, you know, this seemingly big black object floating overhead that was moving at a very slow pace and, you know, like I said, blacked out the sky. That's really intriguing to me. I mean, I don't doubt that those folks saw that, and the fact that it was reported by more than one person in more than one location certainly lends credence to the fact that there was something there. Again, but, you know, saying there's something there and then making the claim that it was extraterrestrial or something, we can't do that because we don't know what was there. The part about, you know, if you have X number of people that see something Let me give you an example. And, you know, in when we had the tragedy of 9/11, for a while on the internet, there was a picture of smoke coming from one of the buildings when one of the buildings was collapsing. And you know, there was a figure in a shape in the smoke that looked like what we think of as being the devil.
Right.
So, you know, it went around and said, oh, look, this is the work of the devil. Okay, well, you know, clearly lots of people saw that. But is that evidence that the devil was at work? Did the devil have a hand in bringing down 9/11? You know, one, I mean, a lot of people are going to reject that immediately because they're like, no, there's no devil. But the other part of it is, you know, how do we investigate that? Well, you know, if we were able to capture the smoke that was there, we could, you know, determine if there was something metaphysical about it appearing. But, you know, obviously we don't have that available to us. But again, just because a lot of people observe something doesn't necessarily, it clearly acknowledges that a lot of people saw something, but what they saw, that's what's in question. Now, what's interesting to me is when people claim that it was the devil, if you look cross-culturally, the devil, you know, takes the form of many different forms and has many different faces. So it's almost like this devil happened to be the devil that a lot of people in America, you know, the face happened to be the same kind of devil a lot of people in America think of when they think of the devil. Well, why would that be? I mean, is the devil, you know, purposely trying to appear in a Western European face? Or, I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's kind of like he calls into question these kinds of things.
It's kind of like when an alien lands and it takes on an English accent when it landed in England.
Right. Yeah. That was just for the benefit of the common local folk, you know.
That's right. That's right. A couple of questions on the chat room.
Sure.
And Eric wants to know how, what do you think about the memory of individuals of recalling sightings from years ago?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the whole memory recollection phenomenon, that's, you know, I think I have a tendency to agree with the, you know, the different people that say they're remembering something. And if you're remembering a sighting that you've had, you know, X numbers of years ago, it's really, you know, it's kind of no different than remembering a sighting you had just the other day. It's still, you're still making a claim about something that you saw. The question is, you know, perhaps why did you not remember it for a period of time? Or the question is it any more valid than a sighting that's made, you know, immediately? And again, I think that regardless of when the sighting was made, it falls into the camp that, okay, you saw something, but what exactly was it that you saw? We don't know. You know, that's kind of the way that I would respond to that. Again, what evidence do you have other than you saw something?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have more evidence than that? If you don't, then that just goes into the I saw something, I'm not sure what it was file.
Okay. Excuse me. We have another question here, and it's why do you think people so strongly want to believe that we are being visited as a sociologist, that is?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not a psychologist, and I don't subscribe to, you know, these theories that we have these deep needs for meaning or something like that. As a sociologist, I look at, you know, kind of what's, in this case, what's in the public narrative, like what's available for people to know about and think about and believe in. And I think some of it has to do with popularity. Some of it might have to do with, again, with the conditions that give rise to people kind of finding maybe life routine and drab and those kinds of things. And so something out of the ordinary sparks their sense of creativity or wonder or something like that. So to me, it's more of a social phenomenon. I don't subscribe to the whole, you know, we have this deep-seated need to find meaning in the universe, or that, you know, humans need to have some sense of something greater than themselves. I think those ideas are social in nature as well, that we're led to believe that we have to have these deep-seated, you know, we it's human nature to have these deep-seated desires to know these things. Where, you know, you think about the popularity of different movies. I mean, I don't know. I don't have any evidence for this, but I'd be curious to see if more people today believe in vampires and werewolves than they did 20 years ago. right? Because just think about it. I mean, you know, every show on TV now is about a vampire, or, you know, there's all these teen books that came out about vampires. So, I mean, and if I would have known about that, I, you know, I would have done a survey, you know, 10 years ago, how much do you believe in this? And then now to see if there's any difference. But I think that plays a big role. And, you know, certainly with UFOs, I remember as a kid, my mom telling me about things that she saw that she couldn't explain. And, you know, that really piqued my interest. So I think there's a lot of that that goes on. And clearly people are seeing something, you know. So I think to me, it's more about just, you know, what floats around in the social world and what topics are available for people to talk about and how much interest does it generate. And, you know, it's kind of like similar to I have my students periodically ask me about whether I really think there's a global conspiracy, you know, of, you know, these elites getting together like the Illuminati or something like that, or the New World Order. And you know, the source that I go to, there's another sociologist, his name is Bill Domhoff, and he's been studying power and power structure and wealth in the United States for almost 50 years. And he bases his conclusions, his findings on research. And he says, look, you know, I don't find evidence for this. Yes, there's a lot of connections. There's a lot of people that know each other. But the extent to which, are, you know, these elites get together and kind of plan the future of America, he doesn't find the evidence for that. So I think, but, you know, nevertheless, this is a very popular topic, and it's, you know, you can search on the internet for this, you know, put a New World Order or Illuminati, and you'll get thousands of hits, and, you know, people believe a lot of stuff that's on the internet. So to me, it's more about kind of the social stuff, you know, the stories that we tell each other or what's in the media, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I definitely think the, you know, internet has certainly changed the views of a lot of people. You know, I mean, because it's a good example with myself. You know, I mean, after I had the sighting that I did, you know, I started to do some research online, and you know, I found I found some things that were fascinating and probably accurate, and some things that were totally, you know, bizarre that I had to set aside. And so, I do think that you know, people can buy into a lot more, because information's there, whether it's right or wrong information.
Right, right.
You know, really up to them to really look into or not.
Yeah, and I don't know how many people have been exposed to the ideas that we're talking about. That kind of, what's the threshold for, you know, really good evidence, and how reliable is it, and how trustworthy is it? And you know, the thing about the internet is you can put any claim you want out there, and there's no accountability, there's no possibility to challenge it other than just say that's wrong. So, you know, I consistently tell people, look at the research, you know, find people that you trust. Don't just go to a website. I mean, you can Google anything, but just because it's on Google doesn't mean that it's reliable or that it's valuable, that it's trustworthy. You know, the upside of the internet, I think, is great. I mean, I have friends all over the world. I can communicate. You know, I love reading stories. I love getting all this information. But at the same time, you know, there's a lot of really bad information out there, too. Mm-hmm. And I think what would be really helpful for everybody, and especially in a field like this, is to have that healthy sense of skepticism. I try to encourage people to develop, you know, a critical analytical mind and evaluate the evidence. Where's this coming from? Why is this person saying this? Do they have an agenda? Where did they get it? Has it been vetted? I mean, those are the kinds of questions that I think people need to ask. And, you know, how cool would it be if we were able to take a UFO sighting of some kind and really evaluate it like that and find out what exactly is going on? I mean, I think that we can use the scientific method to our advantage. And if you were able to gather enough evidence to meet that threshold, which in my mind is way beyond a reasonable doubt, but if you were able to gather enough evidence to meet that threshold, then, wow, that'd be incredible to demonstrate that something like, you know, a UFO exists or anything like that.
Yeah, and then there's a part where, you know, there's a lot of speculation, which I, you know, sort of almost buy into or I think about is a possibility, and that is that there may be some small segment of the government that does know or has known that, you know, maybe they don't know exactly what it is, but there's certainly a lot of accounts of some type of cover-up. You know, you think of the Japanese pilot, the cargo.
Yeah, JAL.
Right. You know, and there's so much about that that it seems like that was just, well, you did see it, and we're taking the tapes, and we're out of here, you know?
Right.
It seems
right.
like there's a lot of cover-up like that. What do you think about what do you think the possibilities of the cover-ups?
Well, I think we have a fair amount of evidence that we know that the government does lie. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, if you think like with in the Vietnam War, the Gulf of Tonkin incident never didn't happen. But that was one of the, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back, which really got us into the Vietnam War. 9/11, I remember hearing, you know, the when the towers collapsed and all of the materials in the air and the local authorities were saying that the air is fine, it's okay. And then it came out a couple of years later, well, the air wasn't fine. And they knew at the time that it wasn't fine, but they didn't tell people that because they didn't want people to panic. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's all kinds of, you know, who was it, this most recent NSA guy, James Clapper, and he was testifying before Congress, and, you know, they, one of the Congress people, right, I don't remember, right. the, you know what I'm saying, ask him mm-hmm. flat out, are you collecting data? Well, and he gave some answer, and then he later basically said, well, that wasn't really true. Well, you know, gee, you're under, you know, oath at Congress, and you're basically
and nothing
lying.
Happens. Yes.
Yeah, nothing happens, right? So yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that, you know, how much can we trust the government? You know, I don't know. I think it's, like with them, I have a real healthy skepticism when they tell me things because I have evidence that they haven't been truthful in the past. And that's, you know, that's pretty clear evidence that you can obtain. And the same thing, I mean, I certainly have heard all the reports about a lot of things that go missing or that, you know, people say, don't tell anybody about this. I don't know why they're telling them not to say something about it, but I think there's clearly enough evidence of people and having, you know, documentation that, you know, that they weren't supposed to say anything, somebody having told them that. But as to why they did it, again, you know, that's what's unknown. And is there a government conspiracy? You know, I think the government keeps a lot of secrets. I think that's, you know, whatever, part of their job. But what secrets they're keeping, you know, I don't know. That's I have this fantasy that, you know, the day I die and you know, I'm not sure exactly what will happen, but my fantasy is I'll have a chance to ask the good Lord some questions like who really killed JFK and, you know, are there really aliens? And, you know, I mean, because I don't know where else to get that information. Right. I mean, it's you can't petition the government. I mean, you can do a Freedom of Information Act, but they're not only going to give you certain information. A lot of it's going to be redacted. So, yeah. So again, for me, it comes down to, you know, I need the evidence. I wouldn't put it past the government. But at the same time, I hear people say, how could they ever keep that a secret? They can't keep a lot of things secret. But at the same time, they do keep a lot of things secret.
Oh, yeah.
We know, right? I mean, look what Edward Snowden, you know, released a lot of things that they were keeping secret. Mm-hmm. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it keeps coming up that he's hiding. I mean, he's coming forth with the UFO stuff, which is, I don't think that's going to happen. One of the questions on the message board is, do you think the government is sitting on UFO information, yes or no?
I don't know that I could be unequivocal either yes or no. Again, I would have to put that into the I don't know category.
Well, let's just say someone gave you $100 to bet. If you were going to bet no or yes, which would you bet? I'm really putting you on the spot.
That's okay. I would have to bet no.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah. All because right. I would rather err on the side of caution.
I see.
You know, you know what I'm saying? Because I don't like to make claims that I don't have, that I'm not confident about. I don't like to make claims or even suggest something that I really don't have evidence for. So I would much rather say no and be wrong than say yes and be wrong.
Well, then this will lead me to asking this question. So what do you think happened at Roswell? Any guesses there? Have you looked into Roswell?
Oh, yeah, a lot, right? I mean, I think it's fascinating. I certainly, you know, that's one of those ones that, okay, the evidence that I've seen, and granted, you know, I don't have any special access, and I'm sure there's a lot of people that have better evidence than I do. I certainly don't believe it was a weather balloon. I mean, I think that the initial reports about it being something, you know, the flying saucer, I understand why they called it that, but I think there was something there that I certainly don't believe was a weather balloon. I'm not sure what it was, but I don't believe the government story. I think that's pretty far fetched, and I think that that's been pretty well established by a lot of other people, and mainly because I think at the time, you know, the initial report, I think it was made out of sheer innocence, right? Mm-hmm. The guy. Hey, that's what happened. Let's report it. You know, UFOs are going around. And so I have a much, much greater tendency to believe the initial report than the government coming out later and saying, oh, no, that was wrong. That was wrong. That's about all I can say. I mean, yeah. Would I love for there to be aliens hidden away at Wright-Patterson? Yeah, that'd be really cool, you know. But again, I need to see them.
Well, you know, the fact that I think it's rather humorous that the Air Force comes forward and says that, oh, those weren't aliens. Those were crash test dummies.
Right.
For parachuting.
When those, high altitude.
Yes. And those hadn't even come out till I think it was 5 years later or something like that.
Yeah,
that
right? I mean,
that was a bold lie right there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's one of those ones I'm talking about. They say something, and then you find out documentation that clearly demonstrates that they weren't telling you the truth. That, to me, is evidence that the government doesn't tell us what's going on, right?
Right.
So what's really happening, we don't know. But at least we know that they're not being truthful with us.
And with your background, what would you think if you, let's just say you controlled the United States government. It was mm-hmm. in your lap. And you had a curiosity about UFOs, and you wanted to find out if there is really something, you know, about it that it's true, or if it's known in the government, or what would you do to explore it? What would your ideas be to explore the whole issue?
Yeah, I mean, my knowledge of the federal government is limited. I mean, I know they have scads of departments, I guess what I'm trying to get at. So I don't know the exact department I would go to. I'd probably go to the military first and ask them questions and you know, ask for, I would love to see all the files that people have asked for that have been redacted for all kinds of things, not just UFO.
Yeah.
But I think that would probably be the place I would start. I mean, I'm fairly confident that they have a lot of information about a lot of things that we don't know about. But yeah, I would probably start with the military because I would suspect that they would be the ones that would have been charged with, you know, if something did happen, and, you know, the whole thing about reverse engineering, I mean, you know, I know that the government, the military rather, has, you know, some of the best technological equipment on the planet. So mm-hmm. chances are, if anything was found, it probably got funneled to them, right? I mean, because we're always trying to figure out ways to make better weapons. So so that's probably where I would start. If I could get through all of the, you know, if you kind of saying I had a magic wand and I could, you know, get people to tell me what was really going on. Yeah.
But how would you approach, like, say, if you wanted to take this seriously as a scientist, how would you approach trying to, like, to say, look at a sighting and research mm-hmm. it? How would you approach that?
Well, the first thing, I mean, the going back to Seth's comment, if we had some really tangible physical evidence, you know, that's the main thing. You know, the closest I can think of are the implants or the, you know, alleged implants that, what is it, is a podiatrist somewhere, I think, in Georgia
yes.
who removes them,
Lear.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, I know this has been subjected to different kinds of tests, and occasionally they come up and say, well, we're not sure what it is. Okay, well, that's interesting. We don't know what it is, and clearly the research scientists don't know what it is. You know, does that mean it's extraterrestrial? No, it just means we don't know what it is. So for me, and again, this goes back to your point about how fleeting it is, if there was some way we could get that kind of evidence, I'll give you another example. I also like Bigfoot stuff. I think that's really interesting. And, you know, there's people who claim that they say that some Bigfoots are habituated, meaning that they can, like, feed them. And, you know, it's kind of like a pet where you leave some food out and it comes up and you have some kind of interaction with them. Okay, well, why don't you grab their hair, or why don't you, you know, well, we don't want to do that because we don't want to disturb their lifestyle, okay? To me, that's just saying, you know, I don't have any evidence, okay? Then why are you even talking about it? But that's the kind of stuff that in my mind, again, you know, would be sort of incontrovertible if we clearly, like the metal that allegedly was at Roswell that you could crumple up and let go and return to shape, you know. That would be something I'd ask if I was, you know, if I was in that position of the government. What happened to that? Where'd it go? Let me see it. You know, I want to show it to some of my scientist friends and see what they think about it.
Oh, we would all love to get our hands on that stuff.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. One more question, and we're just about out of time here already.
Sure.
Yeah. One more question on the message board, and that is, what do you think about recall under hypnosis?
You know, I think that's, again, one of those things that I don't think it's very well understood. I think there are claims made about it being an accurate reflection or an accurate recollection of something that happened. But one more time, unless we have something external to the individual to verify the account, then we can't go beyond saying this is what the individual saw, this is what the individual experienced. But how do we account for that experience if we don't have the very thing that the person saw and we can't evaluate that? Then we have to just default to, well, that's what they saw. We don't know why they saw it. We can't explain it. So it goes back to what we were saying earlier. I wouldn't give it any more credence than I would somebody making a report while they're not under hypnosis. It's not like hypnosis has some special ability to make contact with the external environment that regular experience doesn't have. And again, as to what accounts for those experiences is something that I think is not fully understood. I don't even know that, you know, psychiatrists or psychoanalysts or whomever would be able to fully understand that. But to me, it's one more time, it's unfortunately in that insufficient evidence box. That makes sense?
Yeah. And, you know, we always talk a lot in this field about disclosure. If you think the government did know, I personally don't think they would ever disclose it. But what do you think about that?
Yeah, I don't think they would either.
Yeah.
I think it would take an Edward Snowden or, you know, somebody like that to do that. And, you know, I mean, again, if somebody not just released documents, but if they were able to get their hand on something that, you know, the government may or may not have and bring that would be really cool. But yeah, I don't see any reason. I think the government only releases information either unexpectedly, you know, through leaks, or if their back is really against the wall, and then they're going to try to prevaricate and, you know, just release different, you know, kind of minimal amount of information possible. So I don't have a lot of faith in that either.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're just about ready to wrap it up, but one more question.
Sure.
If someone out there is, you know, we had a couple of nice comments on the chat board. If someone's out there and they actually want to communicate with you about this topic, is that a possibility?
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah, I'd be happy to.
And how would they go about finding you?
My email address is just johneglass, all lowercase, at yahoo.com.
All right. Well, hey, John, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really enjoyed it. It was great.
And thanks, Martin. I did too.
And it's always good to have someone outside of the field, you know, give their opinions. It's always fascinating to me. And
sure thing.
Yeah. All right. So thanks a lot. And,
okay, you bet.
All right. So that's it for the show today. If you missed any part of the show, you can catch it as a podcast and a whole bunch of other free podcasts on our website, which is podcastufo.com. You can also check out our links to stories and our show notes, as well as joining the conversation in our forums. Well, I want to give a quick shout out to a fan named Donna. It's the most bizarre thing. I couldn't believe it. We started, she found me on Facebook. She found me through the podcast website as well. She is into UFOs big time. And turns out we were born in the exact same hour in the exact same town. We're both born in Boston at the same exact time in the same hour. And I think that is really bizarre. And we were abducted at the same time, too. I'm just kidding. Maybe separated twins? I'm not sure. But I want to thank everyone for helping out with the show today. Keith Rowland, the producer for Dark Matter Radio Network. Andy Fleming for the astronomy news. Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse for the music. Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook page. And remember to like us on Facebook for all the latest news. You can check us out live right here at the Dark Matter Radio Network every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And don't forget to jump into the chat room at podcastufo.com. This is Martin Willis reminding you to keep your eye to the sky. See ya.